Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. Today, our destination is Lindisfarne, or Holy Island as it's known. As Gilbert Vilacqua tells us, a place recognised as one of the most important sites in history of Christianity in Britain. A place, as the Venerable Bede once wrote,
a place that with the ebb and flow of the tide is twice a day encircled by the waves of the sea, like an island, and twice rejoined to the mainland when its shore becomes exposed again.
Recorded around the year 700 as Lindisfarne, the name, we're told, possibly means Island of the Travellers from Lindsay. And as Lindsay is defined as island or dry ground in marsh, it seems a fair description of the tidal island described by Bede. The story of Lindisfarne begins in that remote era, to us, usually known as the Dark Ages. And yet this story is one of light, of the shining light of faith, of luminous holiness, of Christianity blossoming. But first, we must go back a little in time. Until the Emperor Constantine issued his Edict of Milan in 313, granting freedom of worship to all, the religion of Christianity was forbidden to the Romans. But as we know, it flourished underground nevertheless. And among the soldiers posted along Hadrian's Wall in the extreme north of England, the most northern outpost of the Roman Empire, there must have been some who were Christians. For at some time in the 3rd century, historians tell us, the faith was planted in those parts. It was after he'd visited Britain that the Emperor Hadrian decided not to attempt to push the empire any further north.
In the year AD 122, the Emperor Hadrian, alarmed by the inability of the loose-knit defences of the occupying Roman army to control the tribes in the north of England, ordered the construction of a defensive barrier from the Tyne to the Solway Firth.
And in fact, the wall runs for 73 miles across England, from sea to sea. From the estuary of the River Tyne in the east to the Solway Firth in the west. Pillboxes every mile, with turrets in between, and some 13 fortresses made the wall an impressive barrier indeed. Though built by the legionaries, the elite of the imperial army, it was garrisoned by auxiliaries from all parts of the empire. Civilian settlements outside the fort walls included shops, inns, and accommodation of sorts for garrison families. So with auxiliaries serving up to 25 years, it's easy to imagine that intermarriage with the natives was common. Some 300 years later, early in the 5th century, the legions were recalled to Rome, itself now under threat from Goths and Huns. And now to Britain came the Saxons, bringing with them their own gods. Thus Christianity lapsed. Or at any rate, as the historians write, it was pushed to the western fringes of Britain and the west coast of Ireland. It was not until the second half of the 6th century that it established its first firm foothold on mainland Britain. In the year 565, over the sea from Ireland came the monk Columba. And on the tiny island of Iona, off the west coast of Scotland, he founded a monastery. And from there, until his death in 597, we read, he evangelised the hills and glens of the western highlands and islands. That same year of Columba's death, Augustine arrived in Kent, sent by Pope Gregory the Great on a mission to restore the Christian faith to Britain. The southern kingdoms responded. The north was a different matter. Kings came and went, and kingdoms were lost and won in bloody battles. But the tide was to turn. The people that walked in darkness were soon to see a great light. the golden age of Northumbrian Christianity was at hand. Historian and local guide Derek Sharman takes up the story of Lindisfarne, this island set in England's northernmost county, Northumberland, meaning probably north of the River Humber. As one writer put it, Northumberland is as far as England goes. And so it is. And as we heard, it was as far as the Romans went.
Lindisfarne, or Holy Island, lies in what is now Northumberland and was then part of the Kingdom of Northumbria. The last 3 miles of road are across a causeway, flooded by the tide twice a day.
And here I must intervene briefly with a warning anecdote. Sometime after our visit to Lindisfarne, I received a newspaper cutting recounting the adventure of a day tripper to Holy Island, who had to be rescued from his camper van while parked on the causeway. When he awoke, he found himself surrounded by water and drifting out to sea as fog descended. He called the Coast Guard on his mobile phone and a major rescue operation was mounted. As he was pulled to safety by a lifeboat crew, his main concern was what his wife would say. They'd bought the van only 2 months previously. Our guide continues.
Holy Island is the place where Christianity was first permanently established in the Kingdom of Northumbria. The kingdom was largely carved out by the warrior king, Ethelfrith. When Ethelfrith was killed in battle in 616 AD, his children fled into exile and found their way to the island of Iona, off southwest Scotland. Here they were given shelter by the Irish monks and eventually took up the Christian faith.
Eventually, also, the throne of Northumbria was regained. Ethelfrith's second son, Oswald, who became king in 634, determined to bring his pagan people to Christ, sent to Iona for a priest. When Aidan arrived the following year, Oswald offered him a choice of land on which to found a monastery. Aidan chose Lindisfarne. Writes Derek Sharman.
The Irish monks preferred to establish their communities in remote sites, where they could feel close to God through the natural world around them.
Perhaps these lines from St. Columba's Island Hermitage, by an anonymous Irish author of the 12th century, render the idea best.
Delightful, I think it to be, in the bosom of an isle, on the peak of a rock, that I might often see there the calm of the sea, that I might see its heavy waves over the glittering ocean, as they chant a melody to their father on their eternal course, that I might see its smooth strand of clear headlands, no gloomy thing, that I might hear the voice of the wondrous birds, a joyful tune, that I might hear the sound of the shallow waves against the rocks, that I might hear the cry by the graveyard, the noise of the sea, that I might see its splendid flocks of birds over the full watered ocean, that I might see its mighty wails, greatest of wonders, that I might see its ebb and its flood tide in their flow, that contrition of heart should come upon me as I watch it, that I might bewail my many sins, difficult to declare, that I might bless the Lord who has power over all, heaven with its pure host of angels, earth, ebb, flood tide, that I might pore on one of my books, good for my soul, a while kneeling for beloved heaven, a while at Psalms, a while gathering dulse from the rock, a while fishing, a while giving food to the poor, a while in my cell, a while meditating upon the kingdom of heaven, holy as redemption, a while at labour not too heavy, it would be delightful.
But Aidan had not been invited to found a hermitage, however delightful. His mission was to evangelise. Derek Sharman tells us what the Irish-type monasteries like Aidan's consisted of.
Small wooden churches with thatched roofs, beehive-shaped wattle and daub dwelling huts, with perhaps a larger building for communal purposes, workshops and so on. Here the monks lived a life of prayer and study. There would also have been a small guest house, a library and a writing room for copying sacred texts. The monks set up a school and trained missionaries who went out to spread the gospel.
But why was Lindisfarne so peculiarly apt for a base? John Adair explains in his book The Pilgrim's Way.
The island possessed three advantages. It lay within sight of Oswald's royal castle of Bamburgh, The sea formed a natural moat around it, ebbing away twice a day to reveal a causeway, and a small rock-girt haven could shelter the largest ships of the day.
And the writer adds a charming note. Aidan, we know, was Irish, but, writes Adair,
with the king, who even acted in early days as interpreter to the Gaelic-speaking monk, Aidan travelled about the kingdom proclaiming the gospel under easily erected wooden preaching crosses.
Oswald, alas, like his father, was killed in battle in 642, and 9 years later Aidan himself died. A curious detail is provided by Butler in his Lives of the Saints. Aidan, it seems, had used the royal castle at Bamburgh as a mission centre, and when he died he was, apparently, leaning against a wall of the church, where a tent had been set up to shelter him. And it's at this point that the second great protagonist of our story comes on the scene. John Adair recounts.
On the night of the 31st of August 651, when Aidan died at Bamburgh, a young, fair-haired shepherd called Cuthbert stood watching his sheep on the lower slopes of the Lammermoor Hills when he saw a vision of angels soaring upwards, bearing a shining great soul. Hearing some days later of Aidan's death, he interpreted the vision as a divine vocation to serve God.
So Cuthbert joined the monastic community of Melrose Abbey, which was situated in the heart of a thick forest on the banks of the River Tweed. But Abbot Butler, in his Lives of the Saints, suggests that Cuthbert did not rush straight off to the monastery after his vision.
Although this was the turning point in his life, he doesn't appear at once to have given up the world. It's been suggested that he may have been called upon to fight against the Mercians, for it was on horseback and armed with a spear that he eventually appeared at the gate of Melrose Abbey and asked to be admitted amongst the brethren.
Not perhaps the image we might have had of the simple shepherd boy playing his pipe on the Northumbrian hills until a heavenly vision revealed that he was to be pastor of a different kind of flock. But the times were out of joint, and the young man may well have been caught up in the regional struggle so common in that period. Eventually, though, he answered the divine call, and soon, we hear, he has become prior and begins a series of missionary journeys all through the lands north of the Roman Wall, preaching particularly, Bede tells us, in those remote districts and villages situated in high and rugged mountains. When the abbot of Melrose was appointed bishop of Lindisfarne, he took Cuthbert with him as prior. Today you can follow their journey north along the 65-mile St Cuthbert's Way, which links Melrose Abbey with the coast at Lindisfarne. But whether it was a nostalgia for the old free life of a shepherd, or the impact of the natural world now surrounding him, Cuthbert began to long for solitude. Whenever he could, he spent long periods on a tiny islet nearby. Finally, he asked to retire as prior and live as a hermit on the uninhabited island of Farne, where Aidan too had lived before him.
If you happen to enjoy that, be sure to look out for part two of Jill Bevilacqua's story. For as we pause there and leave Cuthbert to settle into his new life, we can look forward to continuing his story and that of Lindisfarne in our next edition. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening.